seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Hello, you're welcome along to Golf Weekly. The Arnold Palmer Invitational is underway at Bay Hill. Rory McIlroy has gone all lefty and liberal. And the pod is happy to say that Shane Ryan, author of Slaying the Tiger, will join us today. We have Nathan here. Hello, Nathan.
Hey, Joe.
And Dave McIntyre is in. Fiona's out. Hello.
Gentlemen, hello. I'm surprised we all turned up, given how bloated we are after a spectacular couple of days racing.
That's Cheltenham for the...
Even Malloy is walking around with his pockets full.
Not for long, no doubt. Not for long. So, busy pod, Shane Ryan will join us, author of Slaying the Tiger. Always gives you the truth, which is welcome.
It hurts for the golfers out there, yeah. But for us it's great.
Patrick Ryan was in touch at Golf Weekly NT is where you'll get us. Great news, I'm still getting the pod whilst in Saudi Arabia, listening while building a new golf course.
Not banned.
Not banned in Saudi Arabia. Interesting.
That could be our tagline.
Are there podcasts banned in Saudi Arabia?
Maybe if they've women on them.
Like I just wonder what Patrick's rationale here was. Did he think they wouldn't have the internet or he wouldn't be able to get it? It's not like you're getting us on FM.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There's no geo-blocking.
I'm delighted he's listening to
us. We've lots of listeners in Dubai.
In Saudi Arabia. Yeah, loads.
The Middle East is a hotbed of Golf Weekly listenership.
Why haven't we been flown out there?
Why don't you all meet up and maybe arrange for us to come too?
FJ says, lads, I can't get the pod to work on Acast or Podcast Addict at the moment. Hashtag Android problems. FJ, I literally have no idea what you're talking about. Are you an Android?
I am an Android user, but I use Podcast Republic. Maybe he could try that.
What is wrong with iTunes, everyone?
Yeah.
Just
well,
so
you can't
much easier.
Do it if you're not on an iPhone.
Well, my point exactly. Come on. Paul Hennessy listened to last week's pod on the Abel Tasman Coast Track. A good walk unspoiled. Sent a phenomenal picture of the Abel Tasman.
Quite impressive.
Coast Track. No Fiona here to tell us where that is or what that is. Dave, I don't suppose you know.
No idea.
Great. Christopher McCourt, listening to Golf Weekly NT, at the top of Slieve Dunard, overlooking the number one course in the world, which is?
Royal County Down.
There you go.
There you are.
Beautiful views.
It's an amazing part of the country.
Christopher McCourt, if memory serves me, played with Fiona at our Golf Weekly Classic in Portmarnock some years ago now.
Yes, the Abel Tasman National Park is in New Zealand, which is actually where I thought it was, and I was going to say that.
Back yourself.
Then it was a beach, whereas in my head it was a more of a mountainous area.
Right. Well, he calls it the Abel Tasman Coast Track, so there's a coast involved.
So obviously the mountainous area leads down to a beautiful beach.
Why don't we start a travel podcast? Outstanding stuff out of me and you here. Luke Bradstreet enjoyed the Castleknock special. Said it was a special listening under damp skies at Cowinda Waters. Only me and a black swan out. I checked where Cowinda Waters is. It's 90 minutes north of Sydney.
Yeah.
Very nice. Pro V1 Kenobi was in touch. We were talking about Phil last week. We may ask Shane Ryan about Phil on the pod today. He said, I was the scorer in Mickelson's group once. Him and Bones were grumpy as fuck. It's disappointing to hear. Emma War says, lads, what's the best golf book you would recommend to a friend of the pod? Now, I'll jump in here first because I've had a head start. I saw this tweet and I knew I'd read it out. So I just jotted down ones, both instructional and non-instructional, I went for because I think most people want to improve their golf. I think you have to read Ben Hogan's Five Lessons. You just think you should.
I've never read an instructional book, as you probably won't be surprised to hear.
That doesn't shock me. I also jotted down Golf is Not a Game of Perfect, Barbara Teller, which is great.
Yeah, I've read that.
Yeah, that's really good. That will help your golf, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. The Big Miss, Hank Haney, I think you have to read.
Very good book.
I had A Good Walk Spoiled, John Feinstein. Loved that.
It's not even his best golf book. Tales from Q School is even better. Spectacular read.
Is it? He has good Q School chapters in A Good Walk Spoiled.
He does, yeah.
Really gripping stuff.
I think he got a taste for that in writing A Good Walk Spoiled and decided it merited it. It's a book in its own right.
Well, because the opening chapter in A Good Walk Spoiled is the 1993 Ryder Cup. It's amazing. And he's got like bits of Tom Watson and Paul Azinger and various, you've got all the big names. And then I think chapter two or three is Q School. And I remember reading going, oh, I don't want to read about people I don't know. I don't want not famous people.
Yeah.
And yet the chapter turned out to be amazing. So
the other book that he wrote is The Majors, which is basically him on tour in 98 at all four majors, and it's just incredible.
Right. The Match by Mark Frost is recommended by everyone, and I have it in my room, and I just haven't got around to it yet.
It's on my shelf at home. Bought it online a few weeks ago.
Don't watch the film first.
Okay.
It was on, bizarrely, the night we were talking about it on the pod. Yeah. It was on TV.
That's the power we have. We're like Oprah.
I hope this guy's listening to this with a pen in his hand, because there are a lot of recommendations coming his way.
Fionn met Mark Frost in California over the last month and got talking to him and didn't realise who he was, because Mark Frost has written other great books, and then somewhere halfway through the conversation realised, oh, you're that Mark Frost as well, and Mark Frost is going to come on the podcast in the next.
Excellent.
So we might try and read The Match first. And,
yeah, give us a few weeks to get that read.
Yeah, so try, if you're out there and looking for a golf book, read The Match by Mark Frost, which is meant to be really excellent, and then we're going to have him on soon. Men in Green by Michael Bamberger gets a lot of love from people. Also, Harvey Penick's Little Red Book, Lessons, meant to be excellent. Dave scrunching up his face. And the other two I was going to mention were John Daly's autobiography. There's Blood, Sweat and Tears as well, which is good. I'm in the midst of that. And Fionn recommends His Father's Son by Tom Callahan.
I have that at home ready to go.
Strongly. Fionn gives that two thumbs up.
Yeah. I have two more to add to that. Arnie and Jack. Brilliant about the rivalry of those two. And another Feinstein book, Caddy for Life. It's about the relationship between Bruce Edwards and Tom Watson. Amazing.
Right. I never read Lawrence Donegan's book.
Which is
something on the Four Iron or something.
Four Iron to the Soul?
I don't know. About his time as a caddy, wasn't
it? He was living in, was he living in Donegal at the time?
Not sure.
It's meant to be great.
Yeah.
Well, that's about 10 books, all
Rich
of
Beam.
Which I've read, and they're all excellent.
We mentioned Rich Beam, Blood, Sweat and Tears. So there you go, MOR. Read all them and then come back to us.
And Shane Ryan's book.
Oh, obviously, Slaying the Tiger.
That's one of the more enjoyable ones I've read.
I took that as a given that he'd already read that one, because how could you not have? Hugh Fitzpatrick says, and the loving continues between Beef and Sky Sports. Now he's an analyst and co-commentator. Next he'll have his own TV show. I saw a little bit of Beef.
Yeah, I saw some of it.
How'd he get
as
on?
As long as he doesn't get his own podcast, we're fine. He got on okay, but again, it's this whole situation where Sky are trying to turn him into some sort of circus act. Now, maybe Sky are looking at it and going, he is the only one with a bit of personality out there.
Yeah. They don't have much to work with.
They don't. And he is a willing participant.
That's the other thing. It's not only...
He's dead right. He's dead right. Like, he has the potential to be a very good golfer, but right now he is a decent golfer with a far higher profile than his golfing career deserves. Mm. He's making probably a lot more money outside of his golf game than players of similar stature.
Would you think so? Oh, of similar stature, yeah.
Of similar stature.
Yeah.
But doesn't he have a sponsorship deal in America?
Yeah.
And that is so indicative of how easy it is to stand out from the crowd on the PGA Tour. Different in any way. Remember Boo Weekly? Like, Boo Weekly stood out immediately because he just had that little bit of southern drawl, and he liked shooting and hunting and probably didn't spend much time playing golf. Straight away, he's different to the rest of the fellas on the course.
He did also ride his driver like a horse down the fairway.
Yeah,
right?
Cool.
Like, that takes some beating. Samuel McDonald says, lads, no Tiger and no azaleas. Hashtag Masters. I know, this is very upsetting news. I've been doing a lot of reading about this. So the azaleas at...
What's the issue, Joe?
Well, they've already started to blossom thanks to an unusually warm spring, the azaleas at Augusta. And this is going to be a problem for the Masters, which is still 5 weeks away. So I was looking up the USA National Phenology Network. That's right. It says spring has arrived up to 3 weeks early in parts of the southeast of America. And according to one horticulturalist... That will mean fans won't see the Masters' famous azaleas during the tournament. There's not going to be any colour for the Masters, Tom Rapp told Golf Digest. Now, the Masters usually gets lucky and almost always has the azaleas in bloom for the tournament. They have been so lucky, in fact, that some believers think the groundskeepers go to unusual lengths to make sure the flowers bloom at the right time each spring. It's known as the ice theory. The ice theory, according to John Boyette of the Augusta Chronicle, is that they put ice around the azaleas. They pack ice around the azaleas to keep them from blooming early.
And why did that not work this year?
Well, Boyette doesn't even think that theory is true, because he spoke with a local horticulturist in 2012 about the ice theory, who pointed out that several several big holes in the theory, not least of which ice has a habit of melting when it's warm, which it often is in Augusta.
It does have
this time
a
year.
Wow, the horticulturist is spot on there.
Ice melts.
I guess if you pack enough of it.
Yeah. But the ice theory certainly has holes in it, but there is a sense that those people, those wily people at Augusta, have been doing something.
They'll find a way. Nature will find a way.
To keep the azaleas.
They won't let you down, Joe.
No, but apparently they've already bloomed.
But can they not then freeze them as they are?
Look, I don't know.
Take them away to a secret location, bring them back in the week of the Masters, and all will be fine with the world. It must be great to be a journalist with the Augusta Chronicle. What are we going to write? Well, we better write about the Masters again this week. I've kind of gone through everything we've done. The 10th, 20th, 50th anniversary of this year.
Yeah.
What about the azaleas? Go talk to our horticulturist.
Yeah, well, look, as things stand, no azaleas at the Masters. And I know you're all scoffing and thinking this is the most middle-class conversation of all time right now. But come the first week in April, if there's no azaleas there and you're watching on TV, you'll
be disappointed. You will miss them.
There you go.
They are a staple part of the Augusta National diet. Yeah. I think 07, there was an early blooming of the azaleas, and it definitely took away from the tournament. Zach Johnson, kind of at the time, to be fair, he's backed it up in another major since, but he was kind of the no-name winner
the
that no
terrible.
One was really interested in. Yeah. Justin Rose was getting closer to him. The greens were rock hard. The fairways were rock hard, and it just didn't feel like a really memorable Masters.
No. Trust Dave McIntyre to know the last time the azaleas bloomed early. 07.
I could be wrong now, but I just had this feeling of that time.
You could be right. And then finally, Christian Lane says, listening to you talk about friend of the pod comments by listeners sounds like members of Fight Club meeting in public. Okay, they are all our tweets. We are talking to one of our favourite guests, Shane Ryan, about the season thus far next. Delighted to say that we have Shane Ryan with us, a guest you'll know. Author of Slaying the Tiger. Shane, how many books have you sold to Irish people in the last month?
60,000, all because of you guys. I really owe you quite a bit. One of these days, I'm going to cut you a royalty check. I don't know exactly when it's going to be, but it's definitely going to happen.
You're living in the Bahamas now, aren't you?
I actually own the Bahamas now. So I go back and forth between them and North Carolina. Absolutely.
We had a tweet in earlier asking us what our favorite golf books are. I presume you're an avid reader of golf books and were influenced by guys like John Feinstein. You know, you read Slaying the Tiger and you can see that parallel very quickly.
Yeah, for sure. A Good Walk Spoiled is among his other golf books, but especially A Good Walk Spoiled is something I definitely have read, I think, two or three times. And it's one of my favorites. And, you know, his style of sports writing, I know you guys aren't big basketball people over there, but, you know, today is the first day of the NCAA tournament. And he had a book called A Season on the Brink, which was the first book he wrote about Indiana basketball when they were coached by Bobby Knight, who, again, you may not know him, but he's an insane kind of sports figure over here, famous for throwing a chair across a court one time. But that's, you know, Feinstein's, that book is one of the greatest ever. And A Good Walk Spoiled is, I think, one of the best golf books ever. So he's definitely an influence. And I think David Halberstam is my other, big-time favorite sports writer.
Oh, not overly familiar with him.
He is a political writer primarily who wrote a book called The Best and the Brightest about the Kennedy administration and the Vietnam War. But he wrote, I don't know if you know Bill Simmons. He's a big sports writer here.
Yeah.
His favorite book is called The Breaks of the Game, which is David Halberstam's book about the 1979 Portland Trailblazers season when Bill Walton played for them. But he's written about, he wrote a book about Bill Belichick. He wrote, I'm blanking now, but he wrote four or five sports books that are just really, really fantastic. Oh, he wrote one called Playing for Keeps, which is the definitive book about Michael Jordan, ever written. And he did it without even getting an interview with Jordan. He's a legend. He's one of our great nonfiction writers.
Right. And what are your other golf books you'd recommend?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, your assumption that I read a ton of golf books actually is not true. I think Bud, Sweat, and Tease by Alan Shipnuck is really good. I pretty much like anything Alan Shipnuck writes. I, of course, have read what is Dan Jenkins' fiction book called? I should know this, but I don't.
Not sure.
That's also, I remember it being very good. And but yeah, truth be told, I'm not an avid reader of golf books. Oh. I'm far more likely to be reading something about basketball or baseball or something unrelated to sports at all.
Right. Any reason in particular?
Well, you know, this is something I tried to do with my book. I find, for the most part, golf journalism, and I should qualify saying golf journalism in America, because Europeans do a much better job, but a lot of it here is just very reverential, and it's, you know, basically designed to make heroes and to enshrine these people. Mm. And I don't find that you're always, especially with, you know, writers who are focused on golf, I don't find that you're always getting a really honest take or a really interesting take.
Yeah.
And, you know, that doesn't run the gamut, and I don't want to paint with too wide a brush, because there have been some terrific golf books, but yeah, for the most part, it's just not my favorite genre, I guess.
Yeah, the creating heroes aspect is certainly, we even notice on the TV coverage and generally, and everybody's a great guy. Everybody's, you know, a wonderful family man. It wears thin when you realize they're saying this about literally everybody.
Yeah, yeah, it's right. It's like, if everybody's great, then nobody is, right? And that's kind of the weird, like, gray landscape I get when I read about golf a lot of times. It just is, like, meaningless to me. Every time I see a new story about, oh, this is going to warm your heart, I'm just left totally cold. I'm like, tell me somebody who did something awful. You know, yeah. Give me something that I can wrap my teeth around.
How many golf tournaments a year do you go to now, Shane?
Yeah, not very many at all now. I think last year I went to two. The year before was 2015, so I probably went to four or five. And then when I did my book, I went to, you know, 35 or basically all of them. I don't know. I didn't necessarily plan it this way, but after I wrote my book, I really wasn't involved in golf full time in any capacity. It was just about kind of, you know, I write for Golf Digest once in a while, and they're nice enough to send me to the Ryder Cup or the U.S. Open or places like that. And I love going to Europe whenever I can. But it's certainly, you know, I put in a lot of work, and I don't want to say I burned out on it, because it was really fun, and I maintained my energy to the end of writing the book and promoting the book. But yeah, after that, it was like, hey, do you want to go to the Memphis Open or the St. Jude Classic in Memphis, or you want to go to like Dallas for the Byron? It's like, no, I'm good. I'll stay at home this weekend.
Yeah. And was that in your head when you were writing the book, that you would have that freedom afterwards, that you could sort of write what you want about anybody on tour, and you're not going to be faced down by them every week, and you're not going to be relying on them for stories?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was another really big thing, was that, you know, the fight for access was huge during the year that I wrote this book. And basically, I had to have a mentality of, okay, this is going to be deeply unpleasant. I'm going to, you know, feel awful some days, or some days I'm going to be so pissed off at these like rich golfers who can't give me 5 minutes. But it's going to be something I have to do for a year, and you're just going to have to grin and bear it. Certainly the idea was, when this is over, I'm not anxious to write any other book or to really be in a situation where I have to beg people to talk to me over and over and over. I think maybe I had that in me one time in my life, and that's about it. It's not a fun process. Now, writing the book had a lot of fun things associated with it, but that's not something I really care to repeat.
Of all the golfers, Shane, that you have mentioned in the book, and there's some really cringy parts where you're reading it, and we can feel through the writing how you're feeling standing by a putting green, waiting for somebody to finish a practice hour, knowing that they're just going to tell you to get lost by the end of it. But the all the golfers that you write about, has it ever come back to you in any way? Has anyone mentioned it? Any golfer tweeted you, or anyone that they know got in touch with you to say they weren't happy with what you wrote?
Not really. And I didn't really expect it, because I don't suspect that a lot of golfers, you know, spend a lot of time reading books about themselves or reading books at all. I know Webb Simpson, this is kind of funny. They
read the Bible, don't they?
What's that?
Most of them read the Bible.
Yeah, yeah. This wasn't the Bible. Maybe if I had, you know, like labeled it chapter and verse, they would have been more likely to crack the cover. But no, Webb Simpson, the Bubba Watson chapter was published online. And Webb Simpson, I know, complained about it to a reporter. I heard this secondhand, that he didn't think it was a fair depiction. Now, what Webb Simpson didn't know was I really kind of went after him in the book, too. So, you know, he didn't know that. So my thought was like, well, you know, Webb, if you don't like the Bubba chapter, wait till you get to the part about yourself.
What's the problem with Webb?
Well, Webb Simpson, he kind of like texted his way onto the Ryder Cup team that in 2014. And it's not an indictment of his character or anything, but it is an indictment of the fact that the guy wasn't playing well. he kind of, you know, finagled his way by flattering Tom Watson, which apparently was very easy to do. And if you didn't do it, you were kind of on his bad side. So it was just this example of Tom Watson's poor leadership and Webb Simpson kind of being a little bit sly or a little bit just a little bit underhanded in the way he got on the team. And then, of course, he was awful once he actually made the Ryder Cup team. So that was like a further indictment, I thought.
You mentioned Watson, which means it's an apt time to bring up Phil. Phil has just felt like a very prominent person thus far in the season, mainly because of the interviews he's been giving. So he did that great interview with Shipnook, and he's done Faraday. We haven't actually seen the Faraday one, but we saw him dressed like the Fonz, I think, one listener described it as. Impressions of Phil, like, we've been debating Phil a good bit amongst ourselves just on the back of all these interviews, and there's a pretty broad spectrum of interpretation when it comes to Phil's character.
Yeah, you know, Phil is in a great spot in his life where I think he's kind of like freewheeling a little bit. Like, he'll say anything, he'll tell any story. I enjoy Phil because, like you said, there's so much complexity to his character. He really strikes me as like a classic American character, like somebody like, you know, Daniel Plainview from There Will Be Blood, where there's a lot that's impressive about him and a lot that is like larger than life and you can't believe it. A lot that's a little bit shady. A lot, you know, it seems like with the FBI thing, he kind of could have gotten in a lot more trouble than he did. He sort of dodged a bullet there.
Yeah,
but there's just so many different aspects to Phil. The one thing he never is boring, and there's always something going on with him. And he has that, you know, he has that American charisma where you watch him and you're like, I don't know if this is a good guy, and I don't know if he's, he's certainly not someone you maybe would trust all the time, but there's something magnetic about him that you can't look away.
Yeah.
He gets these great interviews, just like you guys were saying.
Yeah.
I mean, I sound like almost like he's a better version of Trump, where, you know, it's like the guy is just like, there's something about him, as much as like I hate Trump and a lot of people hate Trump, where it's like, oh, he does like sort of capture that energy. But, you know, I don't mean to compare Phil in that way, but I think there is something there about that bombastic kind of American thing that attracts people.
Yeah, and he does love to tell a story where Phil comes out as the hero of the story and is the good guy in the story. I just wonder, listening to some of them. So he repeated on the Shipnook interview those stories about the Tuesday games and going up against Keegan Bradley and the pressure he used to put Bradley over, and he'd try and psych him out, and really he was trying to teach young Keegan a lesson that would stand the USA in good stead when they get to a Ryder Cup. And then he was telling the story about in Faherty, where he was
Matt Kuchar.
With Matt Kuchar, who's the funniest guy on tour, as we now know, which was sort of unexpected, of turning up in these crocodile skin shoes, and you only get to wear these if you've got three Masters. And Kuchar says, well, let's just hope I only win two. That's what do the other players actually make of Phil? Because those stories, particularly about the Tuesday games, I'd love to hear it from Keegan Bradley's side.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's yeah, like Keegan had that one good Ryder Cup, and that was it. You know, and his career has been garbage ever since. And so the narrative of like Phil being the Svengali who kind of leads Keegan to greatness is definitely faded over the years. We hear less and less about that. But no, it is funny. Really quickly to talk about what you said, where Phil's stories almost always feature Phil as the hero, and that's another very common thing with this kind of like American prototype I'm talking about. There's just no self-deprecation. Now, I grew up watching like all kinds of comedy, some of it, you know, from the UK and Ireland. And I think like over there, you guys would know self-deprecation is a huge element of the humor. And it's always something that my friends and I have gravitated to. But when you look at a character like Phil or Trump or whoever, it would be impossible, totally inconceivable for them to ever make fun of themselves or to ever like, you know, humble themselves in any way. But to go back to remind me what your question was. I know I'm rambling.
What
now.
The players think of him?
Oh yeah, yeah. I think young players just worship Phil. I think they adore him, and I think he's the kind of guy that can get away with saying things that maybe some of them are thinking, but would never think about actually verbalizing. Mm. I know, like, if you get the okay from Phil to play with him in those Tuesday practice groups, that's like a dream for these guys.
Yeah,
I think he's a larger than life character. And you know, unlike someone like Tiger, who everybody kind of worships from a distance, I think Phil is the the charismatic like uncle figure that they all kind of look at with wide eyes and they all really like him.
My sporting dream in life is to be Phil's friend and get to play with him on Tuesday. I just want to be in his. I just want to be in his gang.
Let him bully me all day long.
I know. He's got an amazing mind.
I'd laugh at all his jokes.
Well, have you guys seen Training Day? That movie with Denzel Washington and Ethan Hawke.
Yeah.
I picture him like Denzel in that, where he's really charismatic at first, and in the end you get shot because of him.
So, actually, before we leave, Phil, what's the word on his golf and his body and his potential for 2017?
He looks good. You know, I mean, I know he's old and injuries can crop up at any point, and he hasn't been perfectly healthy. But, you know, the fact that he's playing at such a high level at this age, I mean, that's another, I guess, part of his legend. I hope he continues to be competitive. I really do. I think he will. And I think the guy is this is total speculation, but I almost feel like coming through the FBI thing with no lingering damage has almost given him a second lease on life.
Yeah.
It's like you're playing with house money at this point. So I hope that continues throughout this year.
Yeah, I agree with you, with your opening point where he's just in a great stage of his life and he's freewheeling now. I really get that sense off him. He's just kind of making hay.
Is he totally out of the woods on this? I was reading a story this morning about Phil and the prosecutor, that a prosecutor and a defense attorney at an insider trading trial have both said that Phil Mickelson is pivotal to proving their case and he may be called for evidence. This is to do with the guy who was the actual main guy who was involved in the insider trading, who was earning over 40 million quid at a Las Vegas gambler, that maybe Phil might be somehow dragged back into it again.
Yeah, I don't think it's impossible that he gets dragged in to give evidence, but and this is it's kind of complicated, the law, but the basic thing is that it's a strange little like rule that exonerated Phil, which says that you have to have heard the tip firsthand from the guy at the top who actually had the inside info. Now, nobody knows what actually happened with Phil, but even if he did get the insider trading info, it would have come from an intermediary. Which is basically the same as having it from the top, right?
Yeah,
so if some guy in between says, by the way, this guy in the know told me invest in this stock now and dump it, you know, within a week, you would think that would implicate the person who takes that. However, there's a strange rule that says if there's a middleman, you're off the hook.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't mean he can't be called in to give evidence or whatever. But in terms of being prosecuted, it really seems like he kind of got lucky.
So you've got Phil, who's been his usual magnetic, interesting self. I was just casting my eye at the winners list for the season thus far, and I appreciate that things only really get going in so many years from Augusta on. You know, you cast your mind back to October when the wraparound season started. Brennan Steele won in California. Justin Thomas, I want to ask you about, but you've Justin Thomas's wins elsewhere. You have Matsuyama winning twice. But there have been just a lot of very forgettable weeks, it strikes me, this season, like Cody Gribble, Rod Pampling, Mackenzie Hughes, Hudson Swafford, John Rahm, Adam Hadwin this week. I can't speak for everyone, but I have just found this season especially underwhelming. That could just be me. How have you found it?
Well, I just want to let you know you've just insulted an entire nation of Canadians by calling Adam Hadwin's win forgettable. No, but you're right. You're right. But at the same time, you know, the last month has featured Jordan Spieth, Dustin Johnson, and Ricky Fowler winning.
Yeah.
So, you know, like you said, those October and November events, you almost never have really compelling champions because the really compelling guys don't play in them. I mean, that's their off season. You had Hideki Matsuyama win the WGC in Shanghai. So I don't know.
It's pretty much in sync with other years, I suppose.
Yeah, I just ignore it. I mean, the fall season, the PGA Tour really wants to make it happen. And every time you have these very golfy stories of like, oh my gosh, it's so great that Brendan Steele won for this and this reason. And you're just like, snooze. You know?
Yeah. Justin Thomas then. So he's been a big story. He won in Malaysia back in October, and then he won the Tournament of Champions and followed that up the following week with the Sony Open win also in Hawaii. I look at Thomas, you know, born in Kentucky. I remember first hearing about him. He was the third youngest player to ever make the cut in PGA history when he was 16 back in 2009. And now he's beginning to fulfill the potential and he has his fourth win and he's 23 years old. Am I wrong to think he's utterly boring and there's no depth to him by comparison with Phil?
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. I mean, he's very new. Well, the joke over here all the time is that anytime Justin Thomas's name comes up, you go, oh, you mean Jordan Spieth's friend?
Yeah.
But he's been awesome this year. I mean, especially in January. I mean, he didn't just win. I mean, he dominated and put up some incredibly low scores.
Yeah.
And you know, he was in the mix at the WGC in Mexico. He kind of had a bad Sunday, but he was really good the first 3 days. Yeah, I think he really, so far, I think he probably belongs in that group of, hey, it's another like kid from a country club that's good at golf, you know?
Yeah.
Another like conservative, like 23-year-old who looks like he's about 45, who, you know, is basically exactly what you'd expect of a golfer. I might be wrong. Maybe we'll see a personality emerge. But yeah, for now, I mean, he's just a really, really good golfer who's really young. And at this point, he's mostly been known for his acquaintance with Jordan Spieth. Mm. But he's, you know, it's going to be an interesting year because he's playing so well that, you know, despite his youth, you would think, wow, this guy actually might put up a really good finish in a major this year. Who knows? He could have a chance to compete for one. So we'll see. But yeah, I wouldn't expect any kind of like verbal fireworks from this guy. For sure.
What is it that we want from Justin Thomas? Phil Mickelson, when he came on tour in 91 and then around 95 when he first started playing Ryder Cup, he wasn't exactly mouthing off after every tournament and making the headlines after every tournament, Shane. It took him a while to be comfortable up and confident enough to start saying whatever he wanted.
Yeah, no, I think you make a really, really good point, which is that we can sit here and be like, oh, these guys are boring. But they're, you know, first of all, they're allowed to be boring. Second of all, they may not be boring, but they may be just well-trained to look boring to everybody else because it's good for sponsors. It's good to keep the media off their backs. It's good to kind of help them focus on what they're doing. And, you know, professional golf is a strange life. There's a lot of insecurity, even for guys who are very good. And I don't mean financial insecurity. I mean the kind of insecurity that you never know when the game can kind of fall off a cliff. Mm. So they live a life of ultra selfishness, all ultra focus, and everything is very one note, and that helps them. And they know it helps them. And I'm sure there are older guys on tour who are telling them, this is how you behave with the media. You know, visit like a hospital once a year and don't say anything interesting, and your life is going to be, you know, 800 times easier.
Yeah. So what's the word on Dustin Johnson and his transformed self over the last 18 months, 2 years?
That's great. I mean, Dustin Johnson is someone who always makes me laugh because the golf world always wants to build narratives around people, and a lot of times they're accurate. With Dustin Johnson, it's like they try to tell these stories about how his life has changed, and then you see an interview, and it's the same sort of like happy-go-lucky dumb guy that you would have seen 5 years ago. And I say dumb with affection. I don't think he's an idiot. I just think, you know, he's very much who he is. Yeah. I don't know that Dustin Johnson would be much different now than he was 3 years ago if he had never won a major.
Yeah.
But you know, I could be wrong. Like maybe family life has calmed him down. His game is certainly incredible. I mean, the guy is the best golfer in the world, like, period. I mean, he should go on and win like a major this year. He should win five more majors before he's done.
Yeah.
He should be a Ryder Cup legend. I mean, he's always very good in the Ryder Cup. He's great. I mean, I really enjoy watching him.
I wonder if he just got smarter at covering his tracks.
That could be. But I'll tell you what, if he's doing that, nobody's that smart for very long. If he goes back to the wildlife, I think he'll slip up eventually.
Yeah, I don't think he's got it within him mentally and emotionally to live some kind of a double life.
Mm. Yeah, this is not like a Sherlock Holmes character who like will like walk backwards somewhere so his footprints face the wrong way. I don't think he's that clever.
It was a huge, huge deal over here when Rory popped up hanging out with Donald Trump. I guess because we're such a democratic country, you know, the Irish-American thing, pretty liberal when it comes to American politics, and, you know, Donald Trump is also the worst human being, which may, you know, come onto our radar in the last 20 years. So it was a big talking point, and we sort of felt, oh, well, how do we feel about Rory when he's doing this? I presume it was no big deal over there. It was a story for 24 hours, and that was kind of it.
Well, I actually tweeted, because Rory released a statement saying, you know, this was not a political statement. I was just playing with the president. And I had a tweet, and I was just, whatever, like, Twitter, who cares, right? But I said, you know, sorry, but when you're dealing with a character like Donald Trump, and in a time like now, even appearing with him is, by its nature, a political statement. It is. If you agree to play with him, then you're making a political statement that you endorse what this guy is doing, because otherwise, sorry, if you had any integrity, you would say no. And I love Rory. And I just want to say, and I don't think he thought of it that way. but I think he should have thought of it that way, especially for a guy who has grown up avoiding making any kind of political statement in Northern Ireland for, you know, exactly these reasons.
Yeah.
So I made that tweet, and all of a sudden, like, there were 300, you know, retweets of it. It was crazy. So people over here did care about it. Right. Who knows? Maybe it was all your listeners retweeting me. I don't know. But I thought it was a big deal. I mean, I honestly was pretty disappointed to see that. And I don't think it's going to long-term reflect negatively on Rory for me, because I really do think he was like, the president invited me. But there are other quotes from him where he's like, oh, I was fascinated by the circus act of it. I was always like really interested in what Trump was doing. And it's like, yeah, that stuff was interesting. There's no doubt about it. But for a public figure like him, I would love him to say, you know, it's not just a circus act. This has real life effects on real people. And it would be great if you acknowledged that and didn't treat it like it was just some kind of entertainment act for you to enjoy. But that's the political side of me, which I'm not very good at hiding. Yeah. And, I do wish, you know, in my perfect, you know, ideal world, he would have taken that into account. And it was kind of sad to see that for me.
How do you see the Masters shaping up?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think Dustin Johnson has to be the favorite. Everybody always says that's a course that rewards veterans, and I think that will be the case. I would say Dustin Johnson's the favorite. I mean, like, Phil always plays well there, it seems like, and Spieth always does too. I think Spieth is going to have a lot to prove this year after what happened last year. So I would expect the usual characters. What I don't expect ever at the Masters is for someone new and outrageous to win, like Danny Willett did last year.
Yeah.
That I don't think usually happens. So I think it's going to be a fun tournament, and I think we're going to have a great Sunday with some big names, whether it's Spieth versus Johnson or Rory. You know, I hope Rory, always hope Rory competes well. Whether it's one of these guys, I think it'll be, I think we're going to see big names on Sunday.
As ever, we wholeheartedly recommend Slaying the Tiger. Shane, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you guys. It's always fun. I appreciate it.
There we go. Good to have Shane Ryan on.
Whatever about being Phil's mate, I want to be Shane Ryan's mate.
Yeah.
How do I end up in Shane's gang?
Don't know. I think
hang around with us for long enough and we might bring you in.
Yeah. I think he is part of that younger breed of golf journalists on tour. There's quite a few of them now who aren't as into the... I thought the most interesting thing he said was about how so much of the media is reverential around these deeply ordinary golfers, and they build them up into characters that they're not. And everybody on tour is a great guy, and the whole thing does become too syrupy and sickly, and as he said, loses all meaning.
Yeah, I presume, was that always the case because it was such a gentleman's game, or how much of that came in with Tiger, where they just had to lick his ass because everybody was riding in his coattails?
Don't know, actually. It's a good question. Too young to remember. I mean, the Golf Channel really played their part in it.
Oh, well, it was the Golf Channel at Turnberry in 09. It was a Golf Channel reporter when Tiger missed the cut that said, hey, T, where do we go from here, T?
No.
There is so much.
Where do we
that.
Go from here, T?
There really is.
Yeah. Which was actually a fair question from somebody from the Golf Channel.
Yeah.
You just missed the cut. Nobody is going to watch for the weekend.
Yeah. I don't know. It is a bit. It is for sure a bit sickly sweet. Other bits before we go. So we never really mentioned the action from last week. Adam Hadwin won the Valspar. Anyone seen much of this?
I saw little bits of it. But before we get into that, friend of the pod, Jason Sobel, did a little bit of research and came up with one of the greatest statistics of all time.
This is great.
134 players have played tour-sanctioned events with win in their name. And until last weekend, only Hale Irwin had won a tournament. 134 different players have win in their name. And now we have only Hale Irwin and Adam Hadwin a win.
That is amazing. That gives you a sense of how bored people are around.
That is exactly what I thought. That Jason Sobel went, I wonder how many guys have win in their name. I've got a 1, 2. And then you're into 17, you just can't give up.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, it's all right, there's still about 8 hours to go.
There's a lot of time in the press area to kill. And that's how Jason Sobel
That was
Sobel
time
spent,
well spent.
Spent his Friday.
Alec Baldwin is a good amateur golfer. He might have picked up a couple of W's at his local country club.
It was a thrilling finish. He pipped Patrick Cantlay. So Interestingly, Adam Hadwin had booked his honeymoon for around Augusta time and had the temerity and the lack of awareness of the wider world to talk about how much he hopes he will get some of the money back from his stay at the Four Seasons somewhere in French Polynesia. This is Adam Hadwin, who just won $1.2 million. You know.
Get over it, Adam.
Yeah. He says, I booked refundable airline tickets in case I made it to the Masters. There's always a chance, right? But we're really hoping to recover the hotel deposit. Oh my God, it's only a deposit.
Come on.
The
come
hotel,
on.
The hotel deposit at the Four Seasons. Oh wait, this is the favourite line. This is why I will never like Adam Hadwin again. I understand I don't know, I won a nice check this week. Again, $1.2 million. But I don't like to throw money away.
Who does? Who does?
There's Adam Hadwin.
Wow. That's the Canadians for you.
Yeah. Rory McIlroy has continued his criticism of Muirfield, Nathan, despite the club voting to admit women members for the first time this week. So 80.2% voted.
This is politics,
favor.
Joe.
Yeah.
Don't talk about it. We've had so many texts and tweets in over the last couple of weeks saying, please stop talking about politics. But this is just more politics.
This is more politics.
This is not more of your lefty nonsense, Joe.
I know. 80.2% at Muirfield voted in favour of updating the membership policy on Tuesday. And McIlroy, not very impressed, really. I still think it got to this stage is horrendous. We'll go back and play the Open because they'll let women members in. But every time I go, I won't have a great taste in my mouth. I mean, in this day and age, when you've got women that are leaders of certain industries and women that are heads of state, not to be able to join a golf course, I mean, it's obscene. But if you're famous, they'll let you grab them by the pussy. No, he didn't say that.
it's so unexpected.
Oh dear, it's ridiculous. But they saw sense, and he says, so I'll go back there for the Open Championship at some point. I won't be having many cups of tea with the members afterwards. I did think when I saw this, great comments, I love this. I'm sure that's how Rory feels. I think he really went overboard.
Yeah,
to prove his left-leaning credentials, though.
He's back.
Isn't that what he was thinking here?
Yeah. Listen, at the same time, he could have just kept quiet.
True. Fair play to him.
He does rarely keep quiet, though. And, yeah, it was good to hear somebody coming out strong. Like, 80.2% still means 19.8%
yeah.
decided, we don't want this. And
the balls on those lads.
They were forced into voting again.
Yeah.
The only reason they agreed to this was because they were literally being blackmailed by the RNA, who took the Open Championship away from them. The only reason for being a member of Muirfield is to say that you're a member of a club that holds the Open Championship. It's what gives it its value.
Interestingly, some of the analysis after the first vote was that Muirfield really is meant to be one of the top links in the world. Like, you're talking top five or six. It's just amazing. They half gambled that Muirfield is such a brilliant links course, the RNA wouldn't want to lose it from the rota. That was the chance they took, and obviously it backfired and they had to have this second vote. But that was their thinking.
Well, it's a win for the RNA. Fair play to them. They did take a stand, and it's had its impact. There's part of me that is grudgingly admiring of the old sticklers, the small percentage that no matter how politically incorrect it was and how obscene it was and how against the grain it was, they were not for turning. I don't care. I don't care who thinks what of us.
Would you say you're a sexist now, Dave?
I'd say of all the people in this room, I'm the least likeliest to be
what?
A sexist.
What? I think you'll be outvoted 2-1 there.
Well, that's not a surprise.
What was good about McIlroy speaking out about it was I was surprised by the reaction from most of the golf journalists who went, well done, Muirfield. We can now all move on.
Yeah.
Well, let's not give them too much of a pat on the back here.
Yeah, I think Muirfield got a little bit too much credit here.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're still a disgrace. At least McIlroy called them.
Now, we all are. We're hypocrites when it comes to this.
And they're now a disgrace with no principles.
Mm.
You get the call to go to Port Marnock tomorrow. You're going to go.
Sure. But I don't think boycotting is going to have any impact on Port Marnock.
You're underselling your influence in the golfing world.
Philip Reid wrote a piece during the week wondering what implications this will have for Royal Dublin and Port Marnock anytime soon. I don't think it will have huge implications. The best route, it seems, is that if Rory and the boys really put the pressure on them to do it, to host an Irish Open. I did play with a member there a couple of months ago who said that obviously the vast majority of right-thinking people in the club are more than open to female members, but they're trying to do it in politically clever, mature way. So they're not just firing out an email saying, we're going to have a vote on this, we need to sort this out. The people in the club who want to move towards female members are maybe cornering John in the bar someday and having a chat with him one-on-one and then a few, you know, cornering Tom the next day.
They feel it's been done in a sneaky way.
No, not sneaky. Like just getting the kind of...
They won't have a vote until they're sure it will pass.
There's probably the elder statesman in the club.
They want to make sure they've got the numbers.
Yeah, because the publicity of a no vote is just so horrendous.
So you're willing to sit here in the presenter's chair of Golf Weekly and pass judgment on Rory for playing with Trump. Yet here we are a month out from you having walked 18 holes with a member of Portmarnock and you were perfectly happy to do that?
That wasn't a political statement on my part. There were no photos taken.
Except the one with him with thumbs up on the 18th. Yeah, hey guys, look at me. No women around. Yeah. Such a good day.
Hashtag this place is heaven. Yeah. No. Yeah. We should do a piece on that actually. And I got the sense that day that...
They were right.
This could come out of nowhere. There won't be a big build up. I think conversations are being had in the club and they want as little publicity as possible.
Well, they would love to have the Irish Open at Portmarnock.
It'd be great.
It's where it should be. And I would say pressure will... Now, clearly there's other factors at play. So in Northern Ireland, they get to play at the very best courses, whereas in the Republic of Ireland, it's a resort-type course who'll stump up a bit of cash as advertising. But if it is going to be part of this link swing, like if you can say you can go to Portmarnock the week before you go to Scotland and then on to the Open, or even get into that slot just before the Open.
Yeah. I would happily, every time it's in the Republic, just have it at Portmarnock. Let's get back to the Halcyon days, the 80s. Let's just play to the best course.
Well, I don't know how it was on the best course. The argument it was the best course, but also had the best players in the world. You're not going to go back to the Halcyon days of the 80s. You won't have an Irish Open where Dustin Johnson and Jason Day and Jordan Spieth are playing there with Rory.
You'd have a better shot,
depending on where it is in the calendar.
I think you're underestimating the power of the best Open in the world right now, the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open,
of course,
which is taking place. But they haven't confirmed names yet. Now, today they were announcing all the Irish players are going to be there, Harrington, Lowry, all that sort of thing. But there was definitely rumour that up to 10, 11 of the top 20 in the world could turn up.
Well, we're now having the Irish Open 2 weeks out from the Open.
Mm.
And the Scottish Open is in between. So there could be a quotient to players who don't want to play the week just prior to the Open. They might want to rest. They might want to tune up. Like, suddenly the Irish Open then is a very appetising tournament warm-up.
Do they want to rest and tune up in the UK, though? In the UK or Ireland?
It's a fair point. Like,
I don't know. There's many Americans that want to spend 3 weeks in Europe.
You'd be looking probably at coming over and back. Now, that's doable in this day and age.
I don't see many Americans wanting to come over and back. I know I'm being the naysayer here, but I'm just the general vibe you get from a lot of the Americans.
Oh, I know.
A, here for 3 weeks, I really can't see that happening.
Agreed,
B, flying in for the Irish Open, flying home, and then flying back for the Open.
I think Jordan Spieth, Ricky Fowler, maybe that whole gang, players like Jason Day, guys who are serious about trying to win majors, may look at this and go, all right, why not?
Might try it. I don't know of those list of players who likes to play the week before a major or not. But if you're in Florida, where a lot of them are, I mean, you're talking 5-6 hours. 7-hour flight?
Yeah.
Get out of there on a Sunday night. You all pool your resources together. You get out of there on a Sunday. You're flying west anyway. You're literally home 8, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, Sunday night.
I hear it's 3 weeks. They can come over for 3 weeks.
No, I wouldn't go anywhere for 3 weeks if I was them.
Does Spieth still feel this obligation to the Green Brier Classic ahead of the Open Championship because it was his first professional victory?
Possibly and does, yeah.
I wonder if he'll always hold on to that obligation or whether he feels
he's
served
his purpose.
He
didn't turn up.
Yeah. I don't know, 3 weeks, it depends. If you can bring the family, it's fine. If you're there solo, it's a pain.
Yeah, but you bring the family, you play the Irish Open, you have a week off, which involves going to Birkdale for a couple of days.
I guess the kids aren't in school, it's summer holidays. I don't know, look, put it this way, Portmarnock would certainly do us no harm at all in terms of getting big names.
Well, it's easy for people to get access to, Joe. Remember last year, it was difficult for people. Not everybody from Dublin can get out to the K-Club.
Well, they don't have all the cars, as an angry colleague pointed out to us at length.
At length.
So anyway, yeah, Muirfield's back in the rota. Rory's put the boot in. Like, most of the media were fairly celebratory about the whole thing, I thought, and like Danny Willett saying it's great, and, you know, like that 20% are the ones who are going to have the best seats in the house and be in the clubhouse. What can you do? One last point I wanted to mention, amongst other things, is Jack Nicklaus was playing at Bay Hill, where the Arnold Palmer Invitational is already underway. And he was playing with Ernie Els in the Pro-Am, and the Golden Bear didn't just play. He shot, and this should make most of us feel a bit sick, He shot a 71, which means he broke his age by 6 shots. Just when I was getting my handicap up there, I had to go and not only shoot my second round under 80 since November, but better my age by 6 shots with a 71, Nicholas smiled. Not bad, Jack. Not bad.
Yeah. It's impressive.
It really is.
On a couple of dodgy hips.
Yeah.
He's still got it. It's nice that he's playing with Arnie not there anymore. That St. Nicholas is kind of turning up, stepping in and just bringing a little more appeal to the week, because the way the place it has in the calendar,
yeah,
it's not the tournament once was, and Palmer was constantly having to publicly accept the fact that such and such was opting against turning up, and players were constantly apologising publicly,
yeah,
to Mr. Palmer for not turning up, because it's just so close to the Masters and a lot of players want to be prepping at the moment.
Yeah, the pre-first round betting had McIlroy as favourite, if you're wondering, 13-2. Then they had Jason Day hoping his back holds up at 10-1, and Henrik Stenson, who always does well here. Stenson basically always places at Bay Hill. He's 12-1. Hideki Matsuyama, two-time winner this year, 12-1. Ricky Fowler, a winner not so long ago, 16s. Justin Rose is there. It's still fine. There's still enough star wattage if those guys can muscle their way into the running on Sunday that everybody will be watching this.
It's the second toughest regular tour field of the season. So it's not that bad.
No, it's
There's
fine.
Still a huge amount of good names in there. Who pulled out? Danny Willett has pulled out.
He's ill.
He's ill, so he's not there. Jason Day is the defending champion. He was talking about his couple of hours after winning last year, and obviously what's going to be missing this year is Arnie standing there on the edge of the 18th, which we have seen so many times when Tiger would hold this brilliant putt on 18 to win the tournament, and Arnie would just give that nodding bit of respect for him. So Jason Day went and had a drink with Arnie afterwards last year, and he was a bit dehydrated, as Jason Day, you know, there's always something just ever so slightly wrong. Says he was hammered after having one drink with Arnie.
Stop.
Went on Golf Channel, hammered. Come on.
I doubt that.
This man needs to toughen up a bit.
He does a bit. There's no word on how his back is. I saw analysis this morning on PGAtour.com, and they were looking at recent swings of Jason Day, and they noticed that if you picture Day as he's standing over the ball, he has that right leg, both legs obviously bent and braced. He would, over the past number of years, keep that right leg locked the whole way through, you know, rigid, wouldn't buckle or move at all. And just in recent times, it's beginning to straighten up a little bit and turn out a little bit, and they reckon that's to protect his back, but it introduces an element of timing back into the swing when your previously braced right leg is less braced. So that's something for the aficionados to look out for. I know you'll be watching that closely, Dave.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Maybe he should just shorten his swing.
I don't know what the answer is.
But don't shorten it that much.
Because, sorry.
where does it end?
I'm very tired today. I'm not getting all your jokes. Shane Lowry is a great man to, he just completely straightens his right leg on the backswing, which every coach would tell you, good God, don't do that. But it just shows there are all sorts of ways. Shane's leg would go locked straight, pretty much.
Is there a long-term issue with that?
No, it's fine. It probably makes life easier on your back, as opposed to having this big separation and, you know, real Tiger Woods and keeping the right leg locked and not moving an inch. Shane's is a bit more flowy. It works for him. There was something else I wanted to say.
You get it off your chest, Joe.
Oh, yeah. So watching the coverage this morning, John Daly and Ian Poulter were out. It was on Twitter, you know, the way they're streaming some of it now. And it was just very interesting because we judge ourselves in distance terms, obviously, compared to the pros. But they were like saying, I was on the first tee, 7 a.m. kind of thing, and it was quite cold and they had hats on and everything. And the commentary team were talking about a bunker in the distance and could they carry it? And they were saying, oh, well, look, it's pretty cold out here. So that's maybe a 260, 270 carry tops for the players. And we judge ourselves by them bombing at 330 yards. But it was amazing in the cold this morning. 260, 270 carry was about tops for Daly and Poulter. Just make everyone feel a bit better about themselves.
Is next week our Masters preview or is it the week after?
I know, a couple of weeks ago.
I think Masters preview will feature in every pod from now.
Yeah, but our actual Masters preview will be the week of the Masters, which is still, what, 3 weeks away?
Yeah.
So next week you've got the World Match Play, so.
Where's the World Match Play? It's not in that mountain again, is it?
No, they left. They've left.
They all hate that place.
What is it? Doral? Not Doral. No, they've left the Arizona desert.
Yeah. Scottsdale.
Yeah, what's the name of it?
I don't know. It's up in the mountain. Visually, it's cool. But they all seem to hate it.
Players hated the greens.
The fans can't get there either. It's remote.
And it was weird. It snowed 1 year, didn't it?
Yeah. It looked amazing. It's beautiful.
And they've obviously changed the format as well. They've got the groupings, so you don't have to necessarily jet out for an 11-6 defeat.
Yeah.
11-7 defeat and head home. But it's still really a difficult tournament to enjoy.
Mm. Gents, we'll leave it there. And we'll see you next week.
Okay.
Good luck.
All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket town. Little J.D. Starter kid right here.